Welcome to this episode of Midlife Men. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Nico Morales. Nico, who hails from Albuquerque in New Mexico, he's had his stories about resilience and personal growth and how he faced some of the challenges growing up and then through into his adult life. So, Nico, welcome.
Hey, Philip. Thank you so much for having me.
That's great. Thank you for coming on. Do you want to start by talking about what was your life like growing up, Nico?
That's always a great place to start. Many of the situations that we run into nowadays come from how we thought or how we were trained to think from our younger years. I grew up in a two-parent household here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Both my mother and father were present in my life, which was great. I also had the extended family around, so my tios and my tias, my cousins, we spent lots of time together. The hub of the house was mainly at my grandmother's. So we would spend time at my grandma's house all day, playing around, having enjoyable time there. The formative years were great, but I grew up with this concept that rejection was a constant theme in my life. And where that stems from, Philip, is that I have a younger sister, and she's 2 years younger than me. When she was born healthy, but when she went to a checkup, one of the doctors messed up. And when the doctor messed up, got my sister really sick. And so they told my parents that my sister wasn't going to make it past a year of age. And that threw them into a whirlwind of, what do we do? We have a son, we have a daughter, and their daughter is not going to live past year one. Well, what I learned when I was doing my discovery is that when that situation happened, my grandmother came to the hospital and picked me up. And from ages 2 to ages 6, I spent time on the road back and forth between Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Flagstaff, Arizona, where she was originally from. And I identified that one of my root issues was rejection and that fear of missing out. And that's where I could find the origination of this story.
So what happens to you very early on in your childhood can have then significant effects, ramifications into adult years?
Absolutely. The paradigm, the thought process that we have with situations and circumstances from our adolescence, even our very, very formative years from 2-0 even to 7, and then from 7 to 12, have a tremendous impact on how we think and how we view the world in our adult timeframes. So when I did my own reflection, and here's a tool just to share with some people, what I did is I went back in reverse. So I did this exercise when I was 30 years old, and I reversed it 29. Was there anything that could make me really feel like I was rejected? Was there anything that made me feel like I was missing out? Was there anything that made me feel like I had been taken advantage of? Was there anything that had made me feel like change was scary? And the last one that I used to ask myself was there anything that made me have the need to be right all the time? Was there a fear of being wrong? And after 29, I went to 28, 27, and repeated all the way down to as far as I could remember. And that's where I found the root issue. In addition to that, I've done self-reflection, and I identified the problem of the fear of missing out through an assessment that I have that I got given to by a personal development expert that I trust. And when I found that root problem, then I had to figure out where the root of it came from.
And how do you discover what the trigger was then, or what the cause was? Especially if you were so young, because presumably at the time, you don't realize what's happening because you think that's just normal. Everybody experiences it. So do you kind of bury that? Do you carry it around? How do you kind of open it up and realize that that was the root cause?
Well, I believe that the way to open it up, Philip, is to be honest with yourself. And when you're honest with yourself and you go searching for the answers are going to become prevalent. They're going to pop up. So when I would go search for the answer that, you know what, if I have this root issue of missing out, this root issue of rejection, then I should be able to identify where it comes from. So once you know what the problem is, you could then reverse engineer it and find out where the solution's at. And so that's how I worked it through. I took this assessment, I took this tool, I worked with other individuals to find out the main issue that I was struggling with. And then I did my own self-work to figure out the origination of it. And it's not easy. It's not fun. But it was something that I needed to do in order to mend and heal. And for men, we are very much problem solvers. And so having this as a problem is actually beneficial to the way our brains think, because then we can go looking for that solution, and that solution in itself will help give us other solutions and other insights.
How did it manifest then, these feelings of missing out and rejection? How did they manifest in your daily life?
Well, I learned that the fear of rejection and missing out manifested by needing to be included. I needed relationships. We all need relationships, but I needed relationships. It was a significant need for me. It was something that I needed to have happen all the time. And it manifested with hanging out with individuals who would accept me. Just because somebody accepts you doesn't mean that you need to spend time with them. And so hanging out with people who would just accept me was a problem, because in my early teens, when these issues started to really manifest themselves, I found myself as a newbie in a new school. So not just a new school being high school, but I was at a brand new location too. So I didn't know anybody at the school. And because of that, I would spend time with individuals who probably weren't the best choices. When I was 14 years old, I was invited to hang out with individuals who later on I found out were gang members. And because they were people who included me, I didn't see a problem with it, right? I didn't qualify their behaviors. I didn't qualify their actions with, am I wanting to be with somebody that, or being around individuals, hang out with individuals that conduct themselves in this way. I just saw somebody who wanted to hang out with me. I saw somebody who wanted to accept me. And so that's where it manifested. And then it would do things just to be accepted. So I would get out of my own character in order to be accepted. And I know as grown adults, that might sound weird and like, oh, well, we don't do that now. But if you don't do that now, did you do that in the past? And if you did that in the past, how is that if impacting your current situation right now in the way that you think?
So you're starting to, you know, hang around with people who probably aren't, you know, the best role models or best choice of people to hang out with. What happened next? How did things go forward?
Well, there's a phrase in Spanish that my grandmother used to tell me, and it's "Dime con quién andes y te digo quién eres." And what that means is, show me who you spend your time with, and I'll tell you what kind of person you're going to be. So I was spending my time with individuals who were disgruntled against their parents, who were rebellious, who had aggressive tendencies, and who participated in substance use. And so to be accepted with amongst my peers at this time, substance use was my way in. The aggression was already there. I wrestled from age 7 till 17. So I knew how to handle myself whenever they would try to rough me up. That wasn't difficult for me to kind of fight back and have a way with somebody. So I could stand my ground there. The rebellious behaviors and disgruntled emotions towards my familial group, well, we shared that one. The only place that I didn't fit in was with the substances. So I vividly remember the first time that I got high. I had gotten out of school, and one of them was like, "Hey, we'll give you a ride home. So you don't have to catch the bus today." I was like, "Cool. Get to hang out with people, and I don't have to catch the bus back home. And I get to hang out with people," because when I came home, I was the only one there, right? My mom and my dad were both at work. My sister was at a different school at that time because she ended up surviving. And we got into the car, And all of a sudden, I knew what cannabis smelled like. I could smell it, and they were smoking it. Well, the blunt at the time gets passed around the car and comes to me. And I was faced with a decision there. I either participate in this behavior or I don't participate in this behavior, because it's all a choice on how we choose to act, even amongst our peers. And in that moment, I made the unfortunate choice of participating in the use of cannabis. I don't want anybody getting that thought, well, that's a gateway drug and that's what started it. No, the gateway was that there was a choice made to break my own character, what I knew was right or wrong, break my own conscience, and participate in things that I probably shouldn't have been participating in. And that was the gateway there, is that once I broke character, even at a young adult age, I started to implement that habit over and over again. That continued from age 14 until I was 27 years old. From 14, I started with cannabis. And what I found was that my friends would like to smoke tobacco too. So I found a way to get tobacco products, and I'd sell my tobacco products to these guys that I was hanging out with, be included, found a way to make some extra money. So in my head, there wasn't a problem with it. But we began to cause a ruckus, apparently, at the school. So the principal talked to the wrestling coach, because I was a part of the wrestling team. And the wrestling coach talked to my parents and told my parents, hey, this young man probably shouldn't be hanging around with the people that he's hanging around with. And if he continues to, he's going to go down the wrong path. And my parents made the decision to take me out of that school and put me in another school. Well, the town that I grew up in, Albuquerque, where I still live, is very small. So it didn't. Just because I moved schools doesn't mean that I moved mindset. I didn't move behaviors. I had already found what actions got me accepted amongst my peer groups. And at this point, it was solidified in my head that those actions were moving narcotics, moving products that allowed me to be included with other people. The selling of tobacco let me hang out with different people, not just my own group of friends at that time, but along with other groups of people. So, teenagers, they want to participate in behaviors. Smoking something, tobacco is one of it, regardless whether they're the band, they're the emos, whether they are jocks, most people want to participate in it. Or I should say this, are experimenting around that age. And because of that experimentation, I leveraged that to make myself feel included because of the way that I could obtain certain products and distribute those products.
So this was all fulfilling your need to feel, wanted, part of a group. So I guess that was a bit of a drug in itself, was it? Just fulfilling that requirement that you had.
You got it, Philip. The high that came from the substances was not nearly as high as being included, being accepted, because that was the missing factor for me. Because that was the missing factor for me, when I got it, my brain would release that dopamine. Because what we need is community. That's one thing that I've learned along my journey, is that we need individuals to stand alongside, to stand with, and we need individuals to stand against, quite honestly. And having the individuals to stand alongside and stand with also created the opportunity to stand against other individuals too. Those were the people that didn't participate in the same behaviors that we participated in. And so the high that came from using substances was not nearly as high as the acceptance. And because I could get cannabis, well, Nico, can you get anything else? And so I started to explore other opportunities, and that escalated by choice, of course, to obtaining cocaine, to obtaining pills. I was born in 1990, so I grew up in the early 2000s, and that's when the pills started to really take hold here in America. And you could get a pill for anything, and they're giving them out for everything. And so no longer did you have to go to the local drug dealer. You could go to someone's mom, someone's dad, you can go to someone's aunt, and offer to pay them for their pills. Some of them had pills that they didn't even want to take because they didn't trust pills. And so you just give them a couple bucks for it. And they're like, oh, yeah, here you go. Here's the whole bottle. And I'd take that and go sell it. And so that's where the behavior started to solidify themselves. You know, I'm talking about substance use and dealing here, but the reality underlying result is what is the root behaviors and where are those root behaviors coming from? Because the habits that we build turn into the character that we have.
And did you find, do you think at the time, were you consciously, you know, trying to punish your family, you think? Because did you blame them for the way you were feeling? Or you know, were you just finding that this was a new and exciting way to live your life and had a group of people that you were comfortable with?
I think that it was more of I was finding my own place in the world, and being able to solidify my place in the world made me excited about what I was doing. The quote-unquote moral reasoning was that if I didn't have to take care, or my parents didn't have to take care of me and I could take care of myself, then that would help them out. So that was the moral reason that I would probably do the behaviors that I was doing, not so much legitimate reason, but I was able to identify myself, which self-identity and having an identity is important. And then I was able to carve out my place in the world because we all want to fit in somewhere. I know that's for a fact. I ended up writing a book later on in my life, and having that identity for me is something that I still have to watch out for and be careful with. And I say that because there might be a man listening right now who has the career that they have because of an identity that was pressed upon them when they were young. They might have a certain standard of living that they don't even care about, but it is an identity that they have associated with, attached onto. And because of that identity, that's why they're participating in those daily actions. That's causing them internal tension. It's causing them to turn to vices, to turn to behaviors, to turn to pornography, to turn to overeating, to turn to whatever it is that they're turning to, because inside they don't really want to live the way that they're living. And when you can be honest with yourself, then you can honestly move forward. And that's where peace comes from. Oh, yes, my story has resilience. Yes, my story has transformation. But at the end of the day, what I've been searching for my whole life is peace. And the only time that I found peace in my life was when I accepted who I was naturally, who I was at my core. And for me, that's a person who loves to serve individuals, loves to help individuals, but also needs to set a standard. I'm a standard setter and servant person. And that's where I believe the identity comes in play, that for me, I attach to more than rebellion against my parents. Because later on, say early 20s, yeah, I was 20 years old. I wasn't even 21 yet. I got detained for armed robbery because of the amounts of drugs that I was using and the path that I had chosen to take. I got a reputation for doing things that were far risky. And so one day I got a call from one of the guys that I knew, and he said, hey, my buddy is going to be robbing some people. Would you like to participate and get some of the cut? I was like, yeah, no problem with that. This guy tells me where to meet him, and he says, you guys are going to go on your own. I'm not going to go on this one. Okay, no big deal. It's just a job to me. It was just a gig to me. And the individual gets in my car. He says, we got to make two stops, and then we're going to go get these guys. I'm like, cool, no big deal. So we drive, and as we're driving, we're getting to know each other. We're getting to feel each other out because this is my first time interacting with this individual. And we go to the apartment that he was at, and he picks up a gun there. We go to this other apartment, and we pick up some drugs there because most of the time we were participating in these behaviors intoxicated. We end up calling these guys and meeting up with them behind a grocery store that was local. And I'm sitting in the truck. I got this single cab vehicle. I'm in the driver's seat. The individual that I'm with is sitting to my right. We got the middle console there. We're playing some music. The cab is full of cigarette smoke because we're both high and we're both smoking tobacco. And you can just feel this heaviness in the space that we're at. Attention, because I met this guy less than an hour ago and now we're about to go commit a crime together. Don't think about it at that time frame that way, but that's essentially what was going to happen. And he tells me, I know these young kids, they got a bunch of pills. We're going to set them up. All right, cool. You rob them, I'll make sure that we get away. But when you do that, make sure to get their cell phones and their wallet. That's two things that we got to get from them. So he cocks his gun, says, no problem. I'll get the cell phones and the wallet. Pull up behind this Chrysler sedan. And he calls the guy. He says, hey, I'm here. The guy gets out of his vehicle, which is in front of us. And the guy that I'm with gets out of my passenger side vehicle. And they meet in between the vehicles, the back of that Chrysler and the front of my truck. And I could see the guy that I'm with pull out the gun and put it in the guy's stomach. Be like, hey, you're going to give me all your stuff. Well, unfortunately, the other individual who we were robbing laughed at him. And this gentleman did not take that well. So he grabs him by the back of the head and he grabs the butt of the gun and slams him in the face with it, knocks out some of his teeth. And you can just see the teeth go flying from his mouth. And I look inside of the vehicle and there's another gentleman inside the car. Well, the guy that I'm with grabs the drugs, but he forgets to grab the wallets and the phone. The reason why we took the wallets and the phone was because, one, I wanted their identities in case something cracked off and we needed to take further action. And two, I didn't want them to call the police. The situation escalated at a rate that neither of us were prepared for. So when he got the drugs, he went to the car, pulled out the other guy and was like, yo, give me all your drugs too. And so we got all the drugs, but we didn't get any of the stuff that would kind of protect us. It's weird to say that, but that would protect us. He gets back in my vehicle. He still has his gun and he puts it on his lap, which is now directed at me. And I'm like, okay. He's like, let's get out of here. I'm like, let's get out of here. I pull off pretty accelerated. I make a right down this street. I make another left. I make another right. And I'm trying to get out of the environment, the area. Well, I get onto this main road and I'm going down so that we can go to this park and we can leave my truck there, because at least we'll get rid of the truck for a little bit of time. We won't get caught. And as I'm driving down the street, this cop car pulls out behind us and all of a sudden the lights go on. And I'm like, use some profanity at the time. And he's like, outrun him. I'm like, I'm not outrunning him, because this truck is in my name and it's registered to my parents' house. So even if I try to outrun him, I'm not going to send him over to my parents' house. He's like, all right, pull over. So I pull over. And as soon as I pull over, I had been in other situations with the police where I knew how to charismatically get my way out of it, speak to them in certain ways and deny everything so that we can. If neither of us tell, then we're good to go. But because our relationship, there wasn't any trust between us. As soon as I pull over, he opens up the door and he books it, catches it this ditch, and I see him take off. In my head, he had just ratted us out and I was pissed, because by running like that, he was essentially telling him that we did something wrong. Cop pulls out his gun and he's standing behind his door telling me all these things. Put your hands on the roof of the car. They call in another set of police. And all of a sudden, I have about 10 police behind my vehicle with assault rifles. I can see red dots from their lasers inside my truck. I can see that they're searching, right? It takes about 15, 20 minutes for them to approach me, pull me out of the vehicle. And then they bring the gentleman who was in the passenger seat of the vehicle that we had just robbed in with a car. And they put a spotlight in my face so that I can't see. But I already knew there's only two people. One of them's missing teeth. And I know that this guy that's missing teeth isn't the one that's going to be sitting there. They're in the back of the car trying to identify people. He's at the hospital. So it had to be the other one. And I got detained on armed robbery at that situation. That type of event is what got my attention, because that's when I learned that the identity that I had had was not the identity that I want to have. That identity that I was pursuing of being this individual who could handle situations like that wasn't actually the person who I was. And that's where a lot of the transformation came from. But all I was searching for was peace and acceptance. And so I challenge anybody that's listening, how are you, what extreme things are you doing that's going to ask you to put yourself in risky situations? I know it might be not as risky as the ones that I've taken, but you are risking something. Are you risking your family relationship because of that side piece that you have? Are you risking the peace of mind that you have because your conscience isn't clear because of some of the behaviors that you participate in? Or you might be as risky as I am and risking your own freedom to try to chase that peace.
In your view, Nico, how common is it for, especially where you grew up, for young adults, adolescents to get caught up in this type of behavior?
In my community, it's very likely for individuals to get caught up in this behavior. I would say on average, it's about 70% of individuals will probably conduct themselves in that way. And that's just in my community here in Albuquerque. But I would also say that here in America, and I believe anywhere, that ruffian lifestyle, the gangster lifestyle, the bad boy lifestyle is very attractive. It's promoted. And so having that type of anti-traditional routes is something that will always be attractive. Now, where does that become attractive? I believe that it becomes attractive when that is the most attractive being out there, right? We all want to be somebody that can be admired, is where I'm getting to. And if that is what's being admired, an individual who takes charge, an individual who solves problem, an individual who isn't going to be taken advantage of, then why wouldn't you want to be like that? So on average, my guess would be about 70% of the community gets caught up in some form of this, whereas 30% never even participate.
So it's a big problem that it's widespread. And I guess there's a lot of people who have similar experiences to you then. And what happened? So you were detained. When you say detained, did you have a custodial sentence? Were you sent to prison?
No, I was blessed enough to have a lawyer on hand. My family knew a lawyer, and the lawyer helped me out in beating the charge. So I never got sentenced, never got imprisoned. But I was very lucky in that situation, because without that lawyer, my story probably would have went into prison.
So you were detained for this robbery by the police. Was that the rock bottom, or were there other events that you went through before?
I wish I could say that was rock bottom, Philip. That was not, unfortunately. That happened when I was 20 years old. I didn't make the change from my opiates addiction till I was 22. And by the time I was 22, one of the events that transpired was kind of compounded. I grew up around one of those 30% guys. He was one of my good friends, and he had a younger brother. And it was New Year's Eve, and New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, I partied. I went out with the girl that I was seeing. We had a great time. We partied. We did all those things: drink, smoke, sex, all of it, right? And the next day, I get a call at like 6-7 in the morning. And my buddy, he's telling me, "Nico, my brother's gone." I'm like, "Well, where'd he go?" He's like, "My brother's dead." And again, he's the 30%. He was a guy that never participated in any of these behaviors. And when he told me that, I was like, "Well, what happened?" He says, "I don't know yet, but the ambulance just came to pick up my brother, and I could really use you guys." So I scrabble myself together and I go to meet up with him. And turns out his younger brother had went to a party and took some things that were given to him and didn't wake up the next day. I just passed away from the ingestion of whatever he ingested. And that stood out to me because at this point in my life, I was doing probably about 4 or 5 oxy 80 milligram pills. I was smoking weed on a consistent basis, drinking. And to hear that somebody had passed away from an overdose so close to me, that is what kind of got my brain shocked. I didn't stop because in my 20s, I'd already been through some things that I thought, well, if those didn't take me out, then this won't take me out, right? That kind of arrogance and cockiness that comes with it. But what I found a few months later is that I had an eviction notice on my apartment. I wasn't managing my money correctly anymore. And then I found myself staying in a Walmart parking lot inside of my vehicle because I didn't have the wherewithal to see how much of quality of life had deterred because of my substance use. So those three events right there made me feel like a failure, made me feel rejected, made me feel isolated. And that's when I decided to stop using opiates. Now, the unfortunate part is that I didn't understand that alcohol was a substance as well. So once I kicked the opiates, I started drinking. I just replaced one with the other. So from ages about 24 to 27, I was drinking and excessively drinking. And I found myself in the same cycle. Now, being isolated from my family because I wasn't a very nice drunk. Being isolated from my friends because I had changed my demeanor so much that they didn't want to be around me. The person that they did like as a friend, I was no longer that individual. And I found myself living in a building that only had electricity, mainly because my mom said, here, your grandma left this house. If you want to stay in it, you can, but it better not be your coffin. And to be able to go into my grandma's house in my 20s, I realized that I had really been messing up. And I had been messing up because of the choices that I had been making, because of the people that I had been spending time with. And when I was spending time with those people and making those choices, it wasn't giving me the outcomes that I ultimately wanted. There wasn't a consistent group that accepted me. I always had to do something to have that acceptance. Like it was a quid pro quo, I think is how they say it. If you do this for me, I'll do this for you. That's what the relationship was. It wasn't true friendship. It wasn't true camaraderie.
So what happened then? You know, you've reached rock bottom. You know, you've realized perhaps you've made the wrong choices, taken the wrong path. What did you do next?
Well, I grew up in a household that believed in religion. And so for me, because I don't like authority, I had been anti-religion, anti-authority. I didn't want to be told what to do. But I realized that if I wasn't going to let anybody tell me what to do, then I better be the one that tells me what to do, right? Like if there's going to be somebody you have to listen to, and if it's not going to be the authorities that are available, your parents in your childhood, and then, you know, as you get into your adulthood, the community that you live in has authority that you must follow. I decided that I was going to explore what this religion really was. And so I decided to take a spiritual path down towards changing my life. And I've learned, Philip, that there's three ways that you can change the way that you think. One of them is called EMITs, extreme moments in time. And I've had plenty of those that changed the way that I thought. And I titled those EMITs just because it's catchy. The second way is extreme drug use. And I've done extreme drug use my whole life, so my thought process has already changed. The third one was repetition. And that's why you see monks kind of repeat the same thing. That's why you see religious people repeat the same thing. And so I learned that I better start this repetition cycle. And so I reached out and I talked to this God that my parents had taught me about. And I began to have a relationship with Jesus when I was 27 that transformed my life. Now, nothing about me physically changed other than I had released my substances. like the need and desire for my substances. My job didn't change. The work that I was doing didn't change. And I still lived in this abandoned house, but I had the peace that I was always searching for. I had the acceptance. I had somebody who, for me at least, wouldn't ever let me go. And so it filled all the needs that I wanted. There was consistency in something that was greater than me. I believe that each day we are given is a gift. And so that's where the real transformation came from for me. And in that conversation and transformation, I realized that everything that I had gone through was an opportunity to teach someone else who has been through similar or less extreme examples. The time being arrested, the time being detained, the time spending with my buddy who had lost his brother, that was just the closest death to me, right? After he died, there was other people around me who had died, but in my head, they were casualties to what we were doing, right? And then having my family reject me, like these events, they were something that I could use now. There are ways, they weren't things that happened to me, Philip. There are things that happened for me so that even now I could share my story and hopefully somebody can attach to a piece of it and understand that there is a different outcome. There is something that you are searching for and it's okay to go after it as long as you don't get validated by external things. And I learned that for my practices, I was the only one that can control my thoughts and my actions. That's what I learned. And I began to transform those at a practical level, not spiritual level, but at a very practical level. The way that I used to think wasn't helpful. So I had to transform each and every thought that I came inside my head. Because I realized that we're not our thoughts. They're just passing notifications. And by capturing it and either accepting it or rejecting it, I was able to change the way that I felt. And by changing the way that I felt, I changed the way that I chose to take action. I teach it in my speeches, any chance that I get as T, thoughts, emotions, actions. The thoughts that you have create the emotions that you have, which creates the actions that you take. So if you can capture and start with the thoughts, then you can change the way that you emotionally feel. And if you change the way you emotionally feel, you can change your actions. So a long way of saying how I made my changes is that each and every day I would try to capture more and more thoughts, identify how it made me feel, and then choose to take actions differently from there. And by doing that, I was able to achieve a higher education. I ended up getting a job that paid for my schooling. I was able to write a book. I was able to stop all substances. At this point in my life, I can proudly say that I don't drink. I don't smoke. I rarely use caffeine when I absolutely need to, because that's a substance to me. Sugar is another substance. Like artificial sugar is a substance in my world, and I'm clean of all those substances. I participate in physical activity on a daily basis that helps me stay regulated. It's one of my coping mechanisms. I journal and I read. And those are the ways that I stay sane. And by implementing those behaviors on a day-to-day basis, Philip, that's how I made the change into the individual that gets to sit before you today.
And you wrote a book about it, 5 Things to Know Before You Get Sober. And you also have your own organization called No Halo. So those are tangible manifestations, I guess, of your transformation. How did you get to writing the book?
Thank you for that. The way that I got to writing a book was one of the mentors that I engaged with, because I do believe in mentorship. I do believe in having strong men around you. Here's just a tip for the listeners. You should have 3 people around you, in my opinion, at all times. Somebody who's ahead of you, where you want to be, basically. Somebody who's right next to you that's going along the same path, at the same pace, you know, kind of started off this journey at the same time. Doesn't have to be the same age, but you're headed down the same path at the same starting place. And then somebody behind you who's coming up is usually a mentee that you can share some of your wisdom with. And so one of my mentors asked me, Nico, well, what do you know very well? What are you an expert in? And I was like, well, I'm an expert in getting clean. I knew that drugs and alcohol weren't the out that I needed. But once I got into them, it was hard to stop. And I wasn't going to go to rehab. I wasn't going to go to jail. I didn't believe in those modalities for myself. And so I figured if I could get myself into these positions, then I should be able to get myself out of these positions. And so when they asked me that question, my immediate answer was, I know how to get clean. And so that's where the book came from. He said, well, if you know how to get clean, can you teach it to people? He said, what are some common themes that you noticed every time that you got clean? And that's what I did. I identified the common theme each and every time that I got clean, and I just put those into a book. And that's where the book came from. It was a way to give to other individuals, because there was a gap that I noticed in the realm of recovery. And that was that people would talk about what to do when you're in rehab, what to do after you're in rehab. But nobody talked about what to do before you even get to those places. And so the book addresses that. It addresses the decision that you have to make before the decision. That's how the book came about.
That's really important, isn't it? I mean, that's what I try and identify when I talk to people like you, Nico, is what is that? What was the catalyst, the trigger point? How did you get to the point of trying to help yourself, heal yourself? Let me ask you, do you think you're one of the lucky ones? I mean, the transformation you've been through is incredible, but it must have taken a lot of self-belief, and you must have had to really, you know, dig deep to make that happen. Do you think yours is not the usual story?
Coming from an outside perspective, Philip, yes, I believe it's a unique story. And statistically, I had this doctor do a study on my decision-making and where I was and where I'm at. Statistically, I'm in the 1% of people who use the amount of drugs that I've used, drank the amount of drink that I drank, and now can say that I'm where I'm at, a published author with my own business. There's only 1% of the people that can do that. So statistically, they say, yes, I am one of the lucky ones. For me, though, it's just daily life. Like, I struggle with acknowledging that, you know, it's luck, when for me, it was just surviving another day and doing it in the best way that I could. Because that's one thing that I will say about my life, is that whatever I'm going to do it at the best that I can do it. Like, if I'm going to be selling dope, then I'm going to sell dope the best way that I know how to do it. If I'm going to be working, then I'm going to work the best way that I know how to work. Like, if I'm working just a normal job cleaning toilets, I used to work at a call center taking calls. I'm going to be the very best at it. And for me, that's been the biggest driver. So when I put my head down and do the work according to the work ethic that I have, these are the results of it. So to pick my head up and have people acknowledge, hey, where you're at is unique, where you're at is incredible, where you're at is part of the 1%, I receive it. Luck, I don't like to look at it that way, because in my head, the way that I do this work is I do it in honor of those who can't do it. Like, I do it for the people that I know that died. I do it for the mothers that I know are struggling right now with loving a son, loving a husband, loving a nephew who is hurting, and they're doing everything that they can and they just can't reach him. I get to do the reaching. And so I do it for them. I do it for the aunts. I do it for the grandmas. I do it for the sisters. I do it for them. And I find it that I need to offer the very best example that I can, because at the end of the day, the thing is that the way that I conduct myself now is what I used to think was hard. And so that's why I do it. As a child, I used to think that running around, running amok, causing problems was hard, and that's why I did it. So now for me, the hardest thing to do is to be the best example out there and to take on that weight that you just described there, and serve my community, serve people who are truly seeking to better themselves, because I've learned how to transform it. Exactly like you said, I've shot up heroin, I've smoked crack, I've done acid, I've done robberies, I've done breaking and entering. Like, I've been in fights, I've done all of that. And I've also written books. I've also got higher education. So whichever side they want to discuss, I now have the skills to do it on. And it's a great weight to carry, but you're right, that percentage needs to increase. And that's why I appreciate your platform and one of the reasons why I really wanted to sit and chat with you, because the way that you support men, I believe, is very much needed. Like, men need support groups, whether they want to admit it or not. Your golf buddy is your support group. Your fishing buddy is your support group. Your pub buddy, your drinking buddy, that's your support group. Now, is your support group setting a higher standard for men as a caliber? Because I think about my grandfather. I think about the people that lived generations back. What did they have to do? And would they be proud of the way that I'm conducting myself? That is, for me, something that I need to be an established man. And I need to progress this definition of manliness, because we live in a great time. We live in a time where there's not very much needed. So are we going to become weaker because of it? I think Tony Robbins is where I heard it. And he says, strong men create easy times. Easy times create weak men. Weak men create hard times, and hard times create strong men. And it's a cyclical thing. So which part of that cycle am I going to be a part of? And I've chosen to be a part of the strong men. Yes, I'll create easier times for people behind me, but I'm also going to teach them daily habits to make it hard on themselves so that they can advance this thing that we call manhood.
That's great, Nico. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and talking about your life and the work you're doing now. We'll put a link to your book in the notes. But let me just finish by asking you, you know, what advice would you have for somebody that's, you probably can't reach those people that don't want to listen right now, but what about, as you said before, the parents and the siblings and the friends? What can they do if they know, or they can see somebody's going down the wrong direction? What can they do to help?
I would tell them to be the best example that they can be. For me, one of the reasons why I pursue the lifestyle that I pursue is because I've never seen a man who had a open and honest relationship with their God. I've never seen a man who, in addition to that, had a solid relationship with their wife and their kids and maintained that. And I've never seen a man that had multi-million dollars. I've never seen a man that has all three of those things. And for me, I want to be that man. I want to be the example. And what I would share to somebody that is a friend, a family member, maybe not somebody who's in my path, is, can you be the best version of you for those around you? Because if you can show that you're doing life without substances, if you can show that you're doing life without vices, that's what our community needs. Because if you can do it, then someone else can do it. Everybody's got to put their pants on it the same way. Regardless if you're across the pond or over here in America, you still got to put your pants on. And so if you can do it, then they can do it. You need to be the example. Do better today in creating that example.
Thank you, Nico. I wish you the best of luck and continue with your good work. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for your time and allowing me to be on your platform.
Thank you for listening to the Midlife Men podcast with me, Philip Briscoe. If you want to find out more about the work that Nico does, visit his website, nohalonm.com. And you can find his book, 5 Things to Know Before You Get Sober, on Amazon and on other retailers. If you have a story to tell and you think your experience would help others, then please do get in touch, either via the website, mid-lifemen.com, or email me at midlifemen01@gmail.com. Finally, please share the podcast with people you know or you think would benefit from listening to it. If you enjoyed listening, then please rate or like the podcast. It really helps raise its profile and we can reach more people who might benefit from the stories that my guests share.